If you're a regular mobile gamer or find yourself enjoying noir detective stories from the 1920s, then I've got some good news for you. Because today's video is sponsored by the thrilling murder mystery puzzle game, June's Journey. In June's Journey, you play the role of the titular detective searching for clues during the glamorous Roaring Twenties, all whilst interacting with a diverse cast of fascinating characters. June's goal is to identify her sister's murderer, then bring them to justice. But delving into her family's murky history will dredge up some dark and unexpected secrets. It's the perfect mobile game for all you true crime and murder mystery enthusiasts, as figuring out which on-screen objects constitute clues can be very satisfying indeed. So, if that sounds like your idea of fun, you can download the game absolutely free by clicking the link in the description of this video. And June's Journey isn't just available on Android and iOS devices. It's available to play on your home computer through Facebook Games. So, if you want to travel 100 years into the past in order to solve a chilling murder through thrilling puzzles, download June's Journey today to begin your very own mystery adventure. Let me tell you about the worst day of my life, or more accurately, how the first worst day of my life led directly into the second worst day of my life. The first worst day of my life was the day that I got caught stealing coke from the evidence locker at work. I'm not about to tell you exactly where or what my job was, but I reckon most of you can figure that out. I'm sure some of you out there will be pleased to hear that I was immediately fired and charged. Then, not so pleased to hear that I managed to get away with nothing but rehab and a suspended sentence. I paid the price, though, in a big way. My wife became an ex-wife, and with time, my kid learned to call another man dad. I don't blame her. I wouldn't want to be married to me either. But feeling my kid growing more and more distant, that was a physical kind of pain, you know? I left Maryland not sure of where I was headed. But somehow I kept rolling past state lines until I was in Arizona. Part of it was wanting to be as far away from Baltimore as I possibly could without needing a teach yourself Spanish book, but it was mostly knowing there was a guy out there willing to overlook my legal baggage and give me work, that work being what we called skip tracing. Not many of you will know what skip tracing is, as it tends to be known by another much more loaded title. Those in the job call it skip or contact tracing. Others might call us stalkers or fugitive recovery agents. But I suppose the most recognizable term, the one that gets thrown around the TV a lot, is bounty hunter. If you'd asked me back when I was a cop, I'd have told you that Dog the Bounty Hunter was the dumbest show on TV and that every idiot who rolled around in a vest chasing meth heads is nothing but a cowboy with a death wish. Then a couple of years later, there I was, gearing up with the same crew of freaks and rejects that I'd once looked down on from my ivory tower. And the worst part, I really was one of them. A reject through and through. Divorced, recovering addict, a stranger to my daughter. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. But then, after about 2 or 3 weeks on the job, I saw how those guys weren't so dumb after all. And not only were they not the brainless yokels I thought they were, they were just about some of the bravest people I ever worked with. I knew cops back in Quincy who'd rather just discontinue a chase or call in SWAT rather than actually pursue a dangerous suspect, whereas some of the skip tracers out in Pima County would bolt at a fugitive scrambling for his pistol, just for a chance at getting him alive. I remember asking the guy what he was thinking, and in the movies, you'd have him saying something like, "Just doing my job," or "Taking out the trash," or some other nonsense line. Instead, the guy just sat there on the curb, shaking while he smoked a cigarette, just laughing to himself while saying, "I don't know, man. I have absolutely no idea." That guy was gone within a month. Then the next, so was I. Skip tracers aren't known for their loyalty. They go where the money is. At least, that was my policy. I don't know what happened to that guy. I mean, I can't even remember his name. We only worked together twice. But I suppose I'm getting a little off track here. I should be telling you about the second worst day of my life. After bringing in an American-born cartel affiliate and adding such a high-profile recovery to my resume, I basically walked into a job at a very well-paying skip tracer based in Tucson. The salary and bonus schemes were enough to cover my alimony and child support payments, with more than enough left over for me to at least live comfortably. The only catch was that, due to their reputation as better than the average, this particular skip trace company tended to get a lot of high-value bounties, and with high value came high risk. You might assume that the scariest job involved the cartel, or at least those affiliated with them. But the Sinaloa has more money than it knows what to do with, and they know it's easier to throw money at bondsmen or attorneys than to bury the bodies of cops or skip tracers. They're hard to find, but they're easy to bring in. In reality, the people I learned to fear the most were meth heads, and the top of the pyramid was cooks. I'm no chemist, so I don't know exactly what it is about the whole cooking process that does this to them, but cooking meth basically rots your brain. It's a whole other level of crazy. And unlike cokeheads, who are paranoid in the extreme and terrified of law enforcement, meth heads somehow end up on the polar opposite. It's like they relish any kind of confrontation with law enforcement. I mean, they try and keep themselves out of jail for obvious reasons, but they're sure ready for a fight if a fight is coming. I ended up getting a phone call late one night, telling me to stop by the office first thing in the morning for a briefing. When I showed up, you could feel the tension in the briefing room ramp up a notch when the boss mentioned that they were going after a cook. Obviously, he'd skip bail, and word was that he was cooking up some uber batch of meth for some one percenter club so he'd be able to pay for some top-tier Phoenix attorney to haggle down his time in the county. Obviously, that wasn't something anyone wanted to happen, and the guy's bondsman wanted him back bad. Bad enough to put a bounty out on the guy that would have been a cool 10 grand each for a team of four guys, and that was money that I sorely needed at the time. I knew the risks, so did the other three guys who volunteered, and in the end, we paid the price. It took us a couple of days to pin the guy down, and it was only through one lucky break that we managed to get info on his location. Another skip tracer actually picked up one of the guy's associates, who knew well that the cook had skipped on an extremely high bail amount. Although it wasn't exactly lawful, the tracer kept the guy with the info as collateral, telling him he'd let him go if the info turned out to be good, and if it was good, then he'd be cut in on the bounty. We didn't like having to lose a couple of hundred just to get info we might have gotten through less expensive techniques, but the longer it takes to catch a fugitive, the less chance we got of actually bringing them in. On top of that, we were only a few hours' drive from the Mexican border, so time wasn't a luxury we were afforded. As soon as we got the location information, we saddled up and drove out to look for some old trailer park outside of a small town called Aravaca. We were reliably informed that the guy had been driving an old Dodge flatbed, and that if we found the truck, we'd find our man along with it. But almost as soon as we found the place, I started to get a bad feeling about it. The trailer park in question was in a pretty secluded spot, one you needed to turn down an old dirt road to get to. It must have been an old dry gulch or mining spot from a long time ago because the road was basically carved out of the rock, which opened up into a small clearing capable of holding only five or six trailers. And blocking the entrance to the old trailer park was that Dodge flatbed, meaning we have to park the van that we were riding in and advance into the park on foot. That had alarm bells ringing in my head, and it wasn't even the first thing I'd seen that bothered me. Almost as soon as we turned down the dirt road, one of the other guys thought that he'd spotted a flash of movement way up on the ridge above us. It could have been nothing but a coyote or a piece of trash or something, but then again, it could have been a lookout on their way to tell our fugitive that this hiding place had been made. Everyone was intense, but everyone felt ready. We were some of the best skip tracers in the state, probably the whole country, but we had no idea what we were coming up against. The place looked mostly deserted as we walked in, and only two of the dusty old trailer spots had anything on them. We started moving on one that looked like it had been recently occupied, and as usual, we announced our presence, along with who we were, to minimize any chance of violence. 90% of the time, that worked. When the fugitive knows they're dealing with law enforcement, they're way much more inclined to just give themselves up. But after calling out who we were and telling the fugitive we knew he was there, we didn't hear anything in reply. Again, that's not unusual. A lot of guys take their chances and just hide in closets or whatever. Plus, there was the chance that the guy's lookout had given him the heads up and he was running off into the desert while we stood around his trailer like idiots. We knew we had to clear and search the trailers, because even if they were empty and our guys were long gone, we might find stuff that'd tell us where to find him next. We had this guy, Javi, stack up at the front. A scary Mexican dude covered in tats who always gave our fugitive second thoughts about putting up any kind of fight. He hammered a fist on the trailer door a few times, shouting at the guy that he had one last chance to come out peacefully. But again, we heard nothing in reply. Javi then put the boot to the trailer's door, but the second he did, we heard this much louder bang, and 6 foot, 200-pound Javi went flying back into the dirt. We figured someone had opened fire from the inside, and no one goes flying like that unless it's a shotgun. So we backed up a little, and then just started unloading into the trailer to put down whoever had fired the shot. When the lead tracer had called a ceasefire, we were clear to check on Javi. I remember ducking my head into the doorway a few times to check if anyone was down on the inside. And that's when I saw the shotgun rig, clamped into a vise with what looked like fishing line wrapped around the trigger and leading towards the door. The sight put the fear of God into me, not because of the whole evil genius of it, but because it meant that the person who rigged it up might still be a threat. Was someone still applying pressure to Javi's gunshot, which was making him sound off some of the most blood-curdling groans of pain I've ever heard? We backed up into a rough circle to cover all approaches, scanning the area for any signs of attackers. It was always a bad spot to be in, but just then I realized how screwed we really were. All it would have taken was a few guys appearing on the ridges above with a few ARs, and we'd have been mincemeat. All we had was small arms and one guy with a pump action, and they'd taken one of us out of the fight before one was even started. If they'd only stuck around to finish us off, it would have been sickeningly easy. It still feels like a sick cosmic joke that no one appeared to take us all out, like the devil was just dangling our deaths right in front of us saying, "I can take you whenever I want." And that's what sticks with me even all these years later, almost like how the four of us cheated death. Javi survived, barely at first, but he did. And in the end, the cops were able to find the cook that we were looking for and charged him with attempted murder on top of all the other charges he had hanging over him. He won't get out of prison until he's a very, very old man, if he ever gets out at all. And honestly, I hope he dies in there. Anyone could have walked into that trailer, some civilian or, God forbid, a kid. The fact is, he didn't care. He cared more about his own evil cooking operation than anyone's life, and that I just don't understand. And maybe that's what scares me so bad about the whole thing, how I just can't understand what goes on in these people's heads. How some chemical can screw a person up so bad that they just turn into an animal or, no, really a monster, willing to almost orphan a man's kids instead of ending up where they belong, dead or in jail. I quit not long after, and ended up living in my brother's garage back in Massachusetts while taking night school classes and phone and tablet repairs. It's not something I ever thought I'd see myself doing, fixing phone screens for bratty teenagers and clumsy drunks. But it pays the bills, it pays the child support, and most importantly, it keeps me away from the closest things to demons on God's green earth, meth cooks. I remember the day I first noticed a dark blue Chevy sitting in the parking lot when I finished work, then seeing it in my rear view for a few miles as I drove home. Pulling into my parking space back at my apartment, I saw the same dark blue four-door idling in the street, and that was the first time that I thought that I was being followed. But the thought disappeared as quickly as it came as I got out of the car and it disappeared from view. The next day, when I saw the same car in the parking lot after work, I tried to rationalize it by telling myself that it was just some guy who'd started working in the same industrial park, who just so happened to finish his shift at the same time as me. If they really were following me, For sure they'd have been bumper to bumper the whole way back to my apartment, and for sure they'd have been pulled in to check which apartment I was walking into. But they didn't, because it was just a coincidence. Only it wasn't just a coincidence, and I learned that when I looked up tracking techniques on some dumb website about spies. Literally everything they did was textbook stalking behavior. The next day, when I finished work, I actually prayed that the car wasn't there so I wouldn't have to have the confrontation with whoever was driving it. But again, like clockwork, there it was, sitting there on the other side of the lot, starting up its engine just as I reached my car. Like I said, I'm not one for confrontation, but I was so determined to get a straight answer that I found myself just marching over to the car almost without thinking about it. I figured the guy would just zoom out of the parking lot instead of, like, giving himself away or whatever. But he didn't. He just rolled down the driver's side window as I got close and gave me this weird friendly smile before saying exactly, "Can I help you?" I just asked him straight up, "Are you following me?" And I don't even know why I expected him to say anything but "excuse me" with a half-offended look on his face, but that's what he did. I repeated the question, angrier this time, and in the most patronizing and sanity-inducing way, he asked me, like, "Are you okay, man? Bad day or something?" I told him no, that I knew well that he was following me, and that's when he asked me my name. It was such an odd moment to ask something like that, and it totally gave away that he was most definitely following me for some reason. There's no other reason he'd ask me that, and I didn't tell him my name. I just told him to stop following me or I'd call the cops. It makes all the sense in the world to me now why he found that so funny, but at the time, I obviously had no clue. Guy drove off not long after that, and I naively thought that I had the problem dealt with. If he really was following me, for whatever reason, maybe confronting him about it made it look like I wasn't such an easy target for whatever he was planning. But like I said, that was pure naivety on my part. A few nights later, since it was Friday, I was having a few beers since I didn't have to work in the morning. I'm just chilling, watching TV on the couch, when suddenly I hear the buzzer to my apartment. I wasn't expecting anyone, so instead of just buzzing them in downstairs, I headed out to the balcony to lean over and see if anyone was down there. Only, there isn't anyone. Right away, I started getting paranoid, and I figured that it might have been connected to the whole being followed thing, so I went back inside and figured if anything weirder happened, or if I spotted the guy's car, I'd just call the cops and see if there was anything they could do about it. Maybe 30 minutes later, I get another buzz at my apartment. Only, this time I'm thinking, no way am I buzzing anyone in, or opening my door when I'm not expecting anyone. The buzzer goes a few more times, but I just ignore it, and carry on with my evening. Still tense, but not exactly frightened or anything. About an hour goes by, then someone starts bashing on my front door before I hear this girl's voice shout, "Fire! There's a fire!" It might sound dumb considering all that was going on at the time, but I was a little drunk. It was a girl's voice, and honestly, nothing scares me more than the idea of burning to death. I got a bad burn on my leg when I was a kid after my uncle dropped a cigarette on me, and I was seriously scared of fire and burns all throughout the rest of my childhood. So obviously, I jump up, run towards the door, expecting to see smoke and flames as I open up, but when I step out into the walkway outside, I don't see anything like that. But what I do see is that dark blue Chevy sitting right in the middle of the street outside. It was the pure, oh God, moment, where I didn't know exactly what was coming, just that it was probably going to be bad. And boy, was it bad. I didn't even have any shoes on, so I was in no position to actually fight back when someone rushed into view and tackled me from the side. I hit the ground so hard it knocked the wind out of me, like I literally couldn't move as whoever it was dragged my arms onto my back and tied them with something. That gave me the strength to struggle a little. I mean, the last thing I wanted was to be tied up like that, but I heard someone say, "Try to run, not put a bullet in your spine," adding something about spending the rest of my life in a wheelchair and going to the bathroom in a bag. The last part actually scared me. Who says that to a person? And after that, two guys dragged me up and tried to look up to see who was actually kidnapping me or whatever, and bang, one of the guys hits me right in the face and says, "Don't look at us, keep your eyes down." I was certain I was being kidnapped at that point, and they just didn't want me to be able to identify them after they'd release me for ransom or whatever. And that gave me a little hope. Not much, but it was something. They dragged me downstairs, basically threw me down the last few steps towards the end, and it's honestly amazing I didn't break anything on the way down. They picked me up again, with another reminder not to look at them. Then, when I got to the dark blue Chevy, they pulled out a roll of tape and wrapped it around my eyes so I couldn't open them. I figured they'd just take me somewhere after that, but instead, they just threw me in the back seat and stood around outside talking for a few minutes. I couldn't hear everything that they were saying exactly, not at first anyway, but I definitely heard another vehicle park close because I heard the door slam, and after that, I started hearing things like, "Is this our guy?" And then there were about three dudes all talking it out and disagreeing if I was the right person or not. And that's about the same time I realized the situation wasn't all I thought it was. And about a minute later, the door opens and I heard a third voice asking me, "What's your name, kid?" I tell him, and he asked me if I had ID to prove it. I told him up in my apartment, and he rips the tape off my face before walking me back up to my apartment with my wrists still tied above my back. He starts telling me just because he's playing the nice guy doesn't mean he won't beat me if I try to run. But by that point, I knew things would work themselves out when they saw my ID. Thank God they did, because once this older dude said that I was who I said I was for my driver's license, he just about exploded on the guys who I figured worked with him. And it turns out, they were bounty hunters. Actual bounty hunters, like that dog the bounty hunter dude on TV. One of those idiots took me for a criminal that they were looking for, spent a few days coming to the wrong conclusion, then they run an operation to detain me before returning me to the cops or whoever. I mean, thank God their superior showed up, otherwise I might have gone even further. The boss bounty hunter ended up apologizing, promising me an out-of-court settlement for what he called wrongful detention. And he actually showed me the guy that they were actually looking for. Unbelievably, the guy did actually look a lot like me. And as much as I felt resentful to the guys who'd manhandled me, I couldn't exactly blame them for mixing me up with that guy. I was definitely still furious at the time, and I told the guy if he didn't have the guy with the blue Chevy fired for what was definitely incompetence, not to mention being just a total a-hole, I'd most definitely see them in court for way more than just what was being offered. But then, when the check for $5,000 showed up in my mailbox, it came with a copy of all the paperwork filed, showing that the boss man had fired Blue Chevy guy from his company. I was told I could have gotten way more than $5,000, but to be honest, it was just a bonus on top of getting that idiot fired. And in some ways, I guess I was kind of lucky because, due to the mix-up, even though it was completely terrifying and a little traumatic, it does feel good to get some money in the bank. And in some weird way, even though I do hope that they find that guy, as unsettling and unnerving of an experience as it was in my life, it actually was a very happy ending, in a way. Born in Rio Arriba County, New Mexico Territory, in the year 1827, Felipe Nerio Espinosa grew up to be one of the most feared killers of the Old West. His story began in February 1848, when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed. Following the conclusion of the Mexican-American War, the treaty ceded New Mexico along with the sovereignty of its Hispanic settlers to the United States. In the decade that followed, many Hispanic people lost their lands as U.S. courts showed an implicit bias towards European settlers. The loss of their homelands enraged Espinosa and his younger brothers, and by his early 20s, they had become an accomplished group of violent bandits who sought revenge for the injustices their people had faced. As a result of his criminal activities, the U.S. Army was given the job of bringing the Espinosas to justice, and as a reprisal for the young bandits' defiance, his family's home was burned to the ground, and their livestock were slaughtered by U.S. soldiers. This was undoubtedly a huge injustice, but no amount of unfair treatment can excuse Espinosa's response. Instead of targeting those who had put his home to torch, Espinosa began to wage a bloody campaign of murder and torture against innocent civilians in what is now Fremont County, Colorado. His first confirmed victim was found in May of 1863, when a settler was found murdered and mutilated in his mountain cabin. The Espinosas had raided the man's home in the middle of the night, and after shooting him dead, the brothers set about making a gory example of him. They hacked the heart out of his lifeless body, then painted the walls of his cabin with his blood. Before they departed, they left a note stating who was responsible, and that their bloody campaign of rampage had only just begun. As his reign of terror continued, Espinosa wrote a letter to Colorado Governor John Evans declaring that he and his brothers would kill 600 settlers unless their homelands were returned to them. If the governor refused, he too would be targeted for assassination. The threat was taken so seriously that hundreds of bounty hunters and lawmen were charged with tracking down Espinosa. But the bandit king of Colorado was skilled at concealing his movements. Even during the closest of calls, Espinosa always seemed to slip through the net, escaping into the mountains where he would bide his time before relaunching his offensive. As the authorities grew more and more desperate, they began to turn to less conventional means bringing in the Espinosas. Yet contrary to the protests of many high-ranking members of state law enforcement, the solution of Colorado's bandit problem was a man that some considered to be just as villainous. The son of Irish immigrant parents, Thomas Tate Tobin, was a reclusive, antisocial mountain man who spent his life hunting, trapping, and drinking. He too had a somewhat flexible relationship with the law and preferred life on America's frontiers, places where it was almost impossible to hold him accountable for his indiscretions. Tobin spent almost every moment of his life outdoors and was more at home in the wilderness than he was among civilization. Rumor has it that he learned to track game by hunting with Native Americans, that he could read the land like no other. And these were the exact skills that the governorship of Colorado required to hunt down their most dangerous criminal. Tobin was no friend of the U.S. government, and generally only worked for the highest of fees, but when asked to track down Felipe Espinosa, Tobin told the authorities that he didn't want the entire bounty. This confused many lawmen, but those who knew Tobin understood that hunting such a worthy opponent would be reward enough for the blood-drunk mountain man. When Tobin arrived in Fremont County, Governor Evans provided him with supplies, weapons, and a detachment of 15 soldiers to aid him in his efforts. At first, Tobin rode with the soldiers but mainly used them as a means of carrying his supplies. But when it came to actually tracking down Espinosa and his campsites, Tobin rode alone. Not only was he far better at tracking than they were, but they made far too much noise on the trail to be an effective hunting party. Some resented the fact that Tobin treated them like childish amateurs, while others were only too happy to stay behind in camp while the booze-soaked savage went out alone. Some said Tobin would never make it, that he'd end up just another victim of Colorado's most vicious killer. But in reality, Tobin's employ marked the end of Espinosa's reign of terror. It took weeks of solid hunting and tracking, but eventually, while out riding alone near La Veta Pass, west of present-day Walsenburg, Tobin caught the scent of cooked food on the evening breeze. Espinosa usually stuck to making what were known as cold camps, campsites with no fires to emit light or smoke, both of which would give away his position to those that hunted him. But on the night in question, Espinosa believed he was safe. No one had been able to track him for so long before. No one man had been able to follow him so deep into the maze of mountain pines. And so, for the first time in weeks, he and his nephew started a small fire to cook fresh meat on. Espinosa felt safe, he felt secure, but he was wrong to feel such a sense of invulnerability, and it made him and his nephew all the more susceptible to the ambush that they were about to be subjected to. Upon smelling the campfire, Tobin dismounted, hitching his horse to a tree a few hundred meters away. Slowly but surely, the Irishman crept through the pines, his rifle firmly in his grip. A few minutes later, he heard voices coming through the trees, the telltale lilt of spoken Spanish confirming he'd trapped his quarry. Tobin kept low, the fringe of his buckskin disguising his shape as he approached, and as he edged closer, he made out the figure of Espinosa and his nephew. Tobin crept a little further through the trees, raising his rifle as he closed in on him. Yet, right at the moment of truth, the grizzled old mountain man made a single, near-fatal mistake. He stepped on a dry twig. The sound drew Espinosa's attention, and in an instant, he realized he was in trouble. Without knowing quite where the threat was coming from, Espinosa lunged for his Colt revolver, but before he could reach it, Tobin put a bullet into him and sent him tumbling into his own campfire. As Espinosa struggled to keep his clothes from igniting, he screamed for his nephew to flee the camp. But as the young boy did so, Tobin reloaded his rifle, took aim, and sent a bullet tearing through the boy's spine. Espinosa let out a scream of grief as he watched his nephew fall. But as he tried to get a grip on his gun, Tobin rushed in to secure his prey, slamming a boot down on Espinosa's hand before he could arm himself. According to Tobin's testimony, Espinosa offered him thousands of dollars to let him go, claiming he had a huge stash of gold and dollar bills hidden somewhere in the mountains. But money was never something that swayed Thomas Tobin. The thrill of the hunt and the satisfaction of the kill were the only currencies he abided by. Espinosa begged for his life as Tobin pulled out his Bowie knife, his pleas becoming his final utterances as Tobin plunged his knife into his throat, slicing and hacking until the bandit's head came free of his body. Tobin then rode back to the U.S. Army camp from which he'd been dispatched and reported in to the commanding officer who enlisted him. When asked how he fared on his hunt for Espinosa, Tobin simply held up a burlap sack, replied, "So-so," then emptied the two severed heads it contained onto the floor of the officer's tent. The officer was said to be horrified, jumping back and crying out in alarm as the two bloodied heads rolled across the ground towards him. But a deal was a deal, and Tobin's payment was due. As previously stated, Tobin neglected to collect the full bounty that had been promised for the capture of killing Felipe Espinosa, instead opting for a brand new Henry repeating rifle, an item far more valuable to him than mere wealth. Surprisingly, Tobin outlived his blood-soaked career as a bounty hunter and lived to the ripe old age of 81. He was survived by his wife, Maria Bernal, and their daughter, Pascualita. Depending on who you ask, Tobin is seen as a titan of the Old West, a mountain man of yore who embodied the American pioneer spirit of justice and adventure. But to others, Tobin was not but a violent drunkard who shirked his duties to his country in favor of hunting his fellow man. Born in the year 1690 in Western Ireland's County Mayo, the story of John O'Maloney began in his late teens when he was arrested for stealing a horse. He was taken to a place called Castlebar, where a grand jury sentenced him to hang for his crimes. Yet just days before he was due to be executed, John was offered a second chance. The only catch was that he would be charged with a truly despicable undertaking, one that no civilized Irishman would engage in, no matter how much money was being offered. So to save his own life, John became a hunter. Only instead of hunting animals, John would be hunting people. Those he hunted grew to be deathly terrified of John, and would come to give him the nickname of Shan Na Sagar, roughly translating to John the Priest Hunter. You see, the Ireland John grew up in was very different to the one that exists today. The country was under complete control of the English crown, and the oppression of native Catholics was far more extreme than in the years that followed. In the year 1709, the so-called Penal Act demanded that every Catholic priest in the British Isles take what was known as the Oath of Abjuration, a verbal declaration of faith which recognized the Protestant Queen Anne as supreme head of the Church. Any cleric that refused to do so was sentenced to bloody and violent death by the English courts. For the most part, Catholic priests either willingly took the oath and continued to practice their faith in secret, or openly refused and became martyrs for their cause. However, there were some who refused to face the judgment of the English courts, opting instead to go into hiding, and it was these priests, along with their secretly practicing kin, who John O'Maloney was tasked with hunting. Given that O'Maloney was already a fairly talented criminal, he was able to pour his sinister expertise into his newfound profession. It also helped that O'Maloney was paid handsomely for his work, receiving £100 for the capture of an archbishop or bishop, £20 for a priest, and £5 for a priest in training. His captives were then bound, gagged, and ridden to the nearest courthouse, where upon their arrival, they would be charged with taking the oath of abjuration. If they refused, they would be tried, convicted, and swiftly executed. Naturally, O'Maloney was despised for his actions, not just for how depraved they were, but also because of how proficient he was at catching errant members of the Catholic clergy. In one instance, O'Maloney had been tracking one particularly wily priest for weeks and saw a local funeral as an opportunity to finally pin him down. O'Maloney also knew that the priest would try and disguise himself as an innocent villager, not daring to wear anything that would give him away as a clergyman. The story goes that O'Maloney hid among the congregation, studying every man present for signs of higher status. He looked for jewelry, those of particularly pale complexion, or those who whispered Latin phrases under breath, but none of the men attracted any major suspicion. It was then that O'Maloney noticed something about one of the black-clad women at the funeral, how she seemed to walk differently than the others, how her stature was larger, and how at no point did she breathe a word during any of the psalms or hymns. She seemed to be far more masculine than any other woman present, and suddenly, O'Maloney realized he wasn't looking at a woman at all. When the funeral concluded, he followed the figure until they were separated from the larger crowd. Then, despite the fox protests of those present, O'Maloney tore off the so-called woman's headwear, revealing the very male priest he'd been hunting for the better part of a month. In another instance, a priest heard that a member of his congregation was on death's door and desperately required a final confession and the last rites, lest they be damned to an eternity in hell. Never one to neglect their duties or the needs of their congregation, the priest agreed to travel in secret to the dying man's home, shrouded by the dead of night. Welcomed into the man's home by a seemingly grieving soon-to-be widow, the priest entered the man's dark, barely lit bedchambers to find him bundled up in white linen, attempting in vain to keep the biting cold at bay. The priest approached the dying member of the congregation, who began to weakly whisper his final confession. The priest kneeled by his side, gently asking the man to raise his voice so that his sins could be heard and fully absolved. Then, right when the priest had completely let his guard down, the man shot up from his bed, reached under a pillow, and plunged a well-hidden knife into the priest's throat. The man was no dying Catholic in need of the last rites. It was a well-disguised John O'Maloney, having laid the perfect trap to catch and kill such a cautious clergyman. More than any other, it was this murder in particular which outraged the oppressed Catholics of rural Ireland. To hunt a man using wits alone was one thing, but to use a priest's sense of duty against him was more than they could bear. Ironically, it took a trap to catch a trapper, and when word was artificially spread that a priest was practicing Catholicism in the open, O'Maloney showed up like clockwork. But when the priest hunter closed in for the kill, his prey proved to be no mere clergyman, and was far more skilled in combat than any of O'Maloney's previous foes. As the man held off the priest hunter in mortal combat, a handful of well-placed assassins closed in for the kill, with one managing to get near enough to O'Maloney to stab him to death with a steel dagger. When the priest hunter hit the ground before his attackers, it was as if Satan himself had fallen before his foes. They stabbed him, beat him, kicked him, spat on him, until what remained was barely recognizable as human. Some say that when the corpse collectors arrived to take away O'Maloney's body, they needed a shovel to scrape him off the ground. When all was said and done, the man they called Sean na Sagar was taken to the graveyard at Ballintubber Abbey before being dumped into a freshly excavated grave. Some suggested that his final indignity should be to lie unmarked, lost to a world he had treated so diabolically. But the local populace had already plotted their ultimate revenge. You see, Ballintubber is Catholic land, and even though the abbey there was abandoned at the time of O'Maloney's death, it was still deeply sacred to the surrounding villagers. Nothing would infuriate and humiliate the priest hunter more than having him resting on Catholic ground, and unlike the many other graves in the cemetery, his would be more like a trophy. A trophy of an oppressor laid low by the oppression. A trophy of the ongoing defiance of proud Irishmen and women. For though the English may take their lives, they could never take their dignity. The invasion of Afghanistan was one of the longest and most painfully complex conflicts in American history, and for many members of the military, their tours were the defining events in their service to their country. But for one man, the time he spent in Afghanistan meant torture, death, and madness for some of those he encountered. This is the story of Jonathan Keith Edema. Born on May 30, 1956, in the New York City of Poughkeepsie, Edema enlisted in the United States Army at the age of 21. Edema would later state that he'd served 12 years in the Army Special Forces, but in reality, his military career was short and contained several reports of poor performance. One of his commanding officers, Captain John D. Carlson, once claimed that Edema was, without a doubt, the most unmotivated, unprofessional, immature enlisted man I had ever known. And 4 years before he finally left the military, Major Paul R. Decker wrote that Edema consistently displayed a disregard for authority and gross immaturity characterized by irrationality and a tendency towards violence. Not long after he departed the U.S. Army, Edema found a private military company known as the U.S. Counterterrorist Group, also known as Counter Group. According to the website, the company specialized in expert training for counterterrorism, assault tactics, and other security-related services. The company was active for around 10 years, but in January of 1994, Edema was arrested and charged with almost 60 counts of wire fraud, totaling at almost $300,000. He was convicted of the charges and sentenced to 6 years in prison, but was paroled after serving just three. Over the years that followed, Edema was charged with assault, impersonating a police officer, passing bad checks, and possession of stolen property. He was clearly going off the rails, but like so many others around the world, the events of September 11, 2001 would change his life forever. Edema first traveled to Afghanistan in November of 2001, claiming he was there to conduct humanitarian work. In reality, he was actually providing security for National Geographic, whilst aiding author Robin Moore in the research for his book, The Hunt for Bin Laden. After entering Afghanistan, a number of different humanitarian organizations soon became wary of both Edema's reputation as well as his less than wholesome intentions. The director of one such organization, Knightsbridge International, warned U.S. Special Operations Command that Edema was up to some very shady things. One section of a written letter states that Edema is a very dangerous person by virtue of his carelessness and stupidity, and before he gets someone killed, he needs to be removed from the area. I feel that, given the amount of time that he's been allowed to run around telling people that he works for the Pentagon or the CIA, he has garnered or brought enough contacts to pose a real threat to not only me and those near me, but the overall mission of the United States. Once he was established in Afghanistan, Edema founded a group he called Task Force Saber 7, which included two other Americans and several Afghans. He told several journalists that he was a former member of an unspecified covert operations unit, reactivated and positioned in Afghanistan to hunt for Osama bin Laden, and that he was being armed and supported by the anti-Taliban resistance group known as the Northern Alliance. The truth was that Edema's group was nothing but bounty hunters. They had absolutely no connection to the CIA or the U.S. military as a whole, and the activities he engaged in were not just unauthorized, they were downright evil. At one point, at a press dinner in Kabul during December of 2001, a Stars and Stripes reporter revealed to the attendees that he was very familiar with Edema and his criminal past. Edema reportedly pulled his pistol from his holster and openly threatened to kill the reporter while dinner was being served. It then became evident that Edema was involved in illegally detaining Afghan civilians, as in May of 2004, Adema presented coalition forces with a prisoner he claimed was closely associated with the Taliban. This prisoner was quickly transferred to U.S. officials, but upon further examination, it was discovered that the man had absolutely no links to the Taliban whatsoever. Not only that, but the man claimed that Adema had held him in a private prison, hidden away somewhere in the Afghan mountains. The prisoner described hellish conditions in which prisoners were forced to stay awake for days, as well as being subjected to routine and brutal torture techniques. Adema was said to have employed a dedicated team of Afghan torturers, men who not only specialized in some of the most horrifying torture methods known to man, but seemed to relish in the task of inflicting terrifying amounts of pain. The prisoner claimed that one such man kept the nails and teeth that he'd ripped from his victim's fingers and mouths, and that another kept prisoners in bedchambers, violating them on a nightly basis under the guise of an advanced interrogation technique. Night after night, Adema and his men would raid compounds in the greater Kabul region, sometimes detaining every male who looked old enough to fight. These men were then taken back to Adema's private prison where they were beaten, tortured, and occasionally executed. Adema didn't care who was hurt, nor how much damage his activities did to Americans' effort to win hearts and minds in the region. All he was interested in was finding people he could claim had links to the Taliban, so he could make money selling them to the Coalition or the Northern Alliance. According to one report, prisoners sometimes had their hands or feet submerged in boiling water, and in cases where fathers, sons, brothers, and cousins were arrested, they were beaten and tortured in front of each other to cause additional emotional distress. One man, who claimed to be an ex-prisoner of Adema's hellish torture chambers, claimed that the screams of the tortured were broadcast to those being held in the compound's various buildings, a method designed to break their will before they too were sent to the torture chambers. During the 3 years that the prison operated, the blood and gore left by the torture victims were rarely cleaned, and infections were commonplace. Some said that, during the summer months, the entire compound smelled like a slaughterhouse, and thousands of fat, black flies would infest their air around the buildings, feeding on the dead and dying alike. It's hard to imagine a more vivid vision of hell on earth than the illegal torture prison that Jonathan Adema presided over, and one of the few consolations his victims received is that the man himself ended up paying for his crimes. In July of 2004, when news of his nightmarish activities came to light, United States Central Command released a media advisory that read, U.S. citizen Jonathan K. Adema had allegedly represented himself as an American government and or military official. The public should be aware that Adema does not represent the American government and we do not employ him. Just a day after the advisory was released, Adema and his American colleagues were arrested when Afghan police tracked down and raided his private prison. During the raid, police officers discovered 8 naked prisoners hanging upside down in one of the makeshift torture chambers. They were so badly beaten and bloody that the officers believed the men were dead. When one of the men awoke from unconsciousness, he began screaming and thrashing, believing the men were there to subject him to additional torture. Following their arrest, Afghan officials charged Adema and his colleagues with illegally entering the country, running a private prison, and torture. Then just a few months later, all 3 men were each sentenced to 10 years in Policharki prison. Ironically, Adema ended up inside the very same prison walls as some of the Taliban insurgents he had sought to capture. And once they discovered who he was and what he had done, Adema had to be protected from several different assassination plots, with his potential killers plotting extremely painful ways to kill him. Despite being sentenced to a 10-year term, Adema was released from prison in June of 2007, when the Afghan government effectively granted him an amnesty under the condition that he immediately returned to the United States. Following his return, Adema was greeted by the news that he might well be charged with war crimes by the U.S. government. But for some reason, these charges were never brought against him. Regardless, Adema chose to leave the United States and immediately relocated to Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, where he became the owner and operator of Blue Lagoon Boat Tours. He began calling himself Jack, and although it's not exactly clear how he chose to lead his life, the circumstances of his death, as well as allegations made by ex-wives, give us a good idea of how he spent his final days. Shortly before his death, former girlfriend Penny Alessi accused Adema of infecting her with HIV when he knew he had the disease. Adema was also arrested by Mexican authorities on charges of brutally beating his wife, meaning he was obviously guilty of engaging in extramarital affairs. Some claim that he had married 9 different women while in Mexico, although only one of them was official, and at the time of his death, he was listed as having no immediate survivors. Jonathan Keith Adema died in January of 2012 as a result of acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, leaving behind a legacy of deception, torture, infidelity, and death. The world might have almost forgotten what he did in Afghanistan during the early years of the 21st century, but many continue to remember them. It had been reported that a video of Adema personally engaging in the torture of Afghans was included in an Al-Qaeda propaganda video that circulated in 2009, and it's safe to assume that the images on that tape motivated many young men to engage in violence directed at American soldiers. Adema might have restricted his murderous activities to one small compound in the Afghan mountains, but his actions may have caused untold violence and hatred in the wider region, and may continue to do so for years to come. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations and save huge on data, located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends, and I'll see you again soon.